the unmistakable aroma of abulonic Holdenblum. On the far wall of the shop, a rack of bins was filled with teas of various colors, blacks and duns and ochres, but also more exotic shades that nature had never intended. What, she thought in a mood approaching panic, if I only want a cup of tea? Small round tables had been set up around the shop and on the little plaza outside. Some were at sitting level, others were tall, and people stood at them drinking and chatting. At this time of day, about half the tables are occupied by a mix of 60-40 locals to tourists. Two Chetanad traders in matching kilts and turbans pondered over a game board. They whispered to each other as Bridget Bond passed by. "Ah, Koo," said the teakeeper behind the counter. "You have come for a cup of Pleasure Pot, our most famous blend." Bridget Bond studied the rows of teas. "I'm not sure." The teakeeper laughed. "A more meditative blend, then. I have gray thoughts. A private blend the consortium makes for a colleague of yours. But I'm sure he'd not grudge you a taste of it." The hound had been curious where the teakeeper had learned the form of address the kennel used among themselves. She could also guess the name of the colleague. Graystroke would have found the name of the blend both amusing and irresistible. I pause and mention Graystroke as another character that's been followed in a previous chapter. The teakeeper went below stairs and climbed back with a canister of plain metallic gray. Turning it, he showed her the embossing on the bottom, Graystroke's personal logo. At her approval, the teakeeper took a carefully measured scoop of the leaves, filled a small perforated ball, and prepared an infusion, discussing all the while the physics and chemistry involved. Bridget Bond only wanted a drink, but the teakeeper would not hand the cup over until a mandatory amount of steeping had elapsed. "It's different for each blend, you see." She didn't see, and she did her best to forget after she took the steaming cup away. The Chetnads are playing shachmat and were in the mid-game. Some versions of the game were played in three dimensions. Some used computers and hundreds of pieces with fluctuating fighting qualities. Still others, called chutes and ladders, mimicked the superluminal creases of Electric Avenue and allowed game pieces to slipstream rapidly between designated squares. But the Chetnads are playing the true game, unadorned, handling finely carved wooden pieces across a 9x9 board of squares. Red, whose turban was an intricate plaid of green, yellow, and red checks and lines, was engaged in Ramur's offer. His emperor stood unmoved in the center square of his home row, while his minions had pushed forward in a complex arrangement of mutual support. The flanking counselors and leaping hounds were in play on the princess side, although the fortresses still anchored the two ends of his line. The princess was in midfield with a good chance to marry the opposing prince. If white allowed that, his prince would become powerless in any attack on red. Hence he was playing MacDevitt's refusal. An unstable arrangement, she thought. Complexity upon complexity. And the least wrong move would send it all crashing into chaos, from which only the most nimble thinker could pluck victory. White's prince was castled, refusing to meet the opposing princess. After a time in which nothing seemed to happen, White picked up his teacup and sipped. He put it down again. Nothing happened some more. Then, with a shrug, he sent a white hound leaping out. A mistake. Bridget Bond took a swallow of gray thoughts and leaned forward a little to see how Red would respond. Red barely noticed. He moved his prince forward one square. "These are bad times," he commented after a sip from his cup. I'm scrolling up here. White's turban, richly green, shot through with ochre threads and golden bands, bobbed side to side in agreement. "The ICC grows bold and arrogant. They strut. The ICC is the Interstellar Cargo Company." Sort of the heavy roller of interstellar traffic. It was the custom of the Chetanan traders when in public to speak in allusions. "Three ships of Shan Company passed through the junction yesterday," said Red. They paid no duties as poor Chetnets must pay. This was said by a customs officer far gone in her cups. Drink makes truth. Wise is a sober man. Would only that such wisdom extended to the movement of princes. White advanced a second hand on the other side of the field, threatening the red prince. Long-lived are the fish that rise not to the bait, Red observed, shifting a minion laterally to white, take a white minion. Why do our cousins in Shan company preen? Strange words have been said. With the aid of sand and iron, they shall make the Ardry himself their minion. He raised his head from the board and met his companion's eyes. Hard words, those, and what did the speaker mean by their saying? White shrugged. It is not for poor Chetnet traders to know such things. To move excellent goods at fair prices is all they desire. The moods and wants of high kings are nothing to them. But what if their rivals should gain such power over kings? Then woe to the poor Chetnet and to his wives and children. Bridget Bond placed her cup on its saucer with a tiny click and said, as if to no one in particular, The Ardry has ears everywhere, but knows not always the meaning of what he hears. White bowed his head and a small smile played across his lips. May the wisdom of the Ardry increase, or that of his ears. Red grunted in amusement. The Ardry, said Bridget Bond, is the servant of the League and its member states. White cupped his chin and studied the board. The Ardry may be a servant of the League, but he cannot wish to be a servant of Shan Company. He moved a counselor down a diagonal. Red made the sign of the wheel and touched his chakras. May the Bood forbid such a thing. That has nothing to do with the rest of the chapter, but it's having to do with something that's going to happen later. Bridget Bond returned to her hotel room and prepared for assignation with Pulaweo. She stripped herself of the uniform and showered the heat away. Afterwards, she inspected the clothing she had brought, mentally inventorying that which remained aboard her ship, and sighed with frustration. Pulaweo had asked that she wear the uniform, but did she really care about the wrapping for the confection she desired? She amended the thought. The surgery was done by now. She needn't worry about dressing seductively. The conclusion was tacitly agreed. So comfort, convenience, and inconspicuousness were the order of the day. Something she could remove and don with relative ease and which would not stand out on the street. Which was sounding more and more like a topless sarong in bright, gaudy colors. She went to the face that sat on a desk by the wall and accessed the hotel system, accepted a nuisance charge to her bill, and slid out into the information slipstream. She screened on the director's name, found it moderately common, and fined up the mesh size with job position and hobby teacup patterns there. As she had thought, Pulaweo took enormous pride in her, in his hobby, thought, damn gender-bending nuisance custom, and had set up an information locus where people could see examples, comment approvingly, and even purchase complete tea sets. Ha! One commentator had written that the designs were insipid. Well, there is more than one way to practice seduction. If the body's surrender was a foregone conclusion, that of the mind was not. And what the hound wanted from the director was not the body. She downloaded the pattern for the teacup she had seen at the STC tower and extracted the colors from the duck's feathers. These she entered into a drawing program and set it for smooth, abstract shapes and long sweeping lines. The result was a pattern that suggested the duck's plumage for the teacup without being a mere representation of it. Imitation was the sincerest form of